Welcome to the Canteen Podcast, a show for anyone who has feelings about food. Join host Ali Houston as guests open up about their relationship with food and their thoughts on nutrition. Nourish yourself with the Canteen Podcast.
Hey everyone, welcome to this episode of the Canteen Podcast. I'm your host Ali Houston. Please don't forget to jump over to iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts and hit the subscribe button. And please don't forget to leave a 5-star rating and review to get the podcast in front of more eyes. This podcast is made possible thanks to paleocanteen.co.uk, which is my company. That's paleocanteen.co.uk. Thanks, and enjoy the show.
Okay, we are recording, and I'm lucky enough to have with me today Nicola Howard, who is an author, coach, and mentor, and started the online community Low Carb in the UK. Welcome.
Lovely to be here.
Thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. Maybe you could start by telling us what it is that you do.
Oh, what I do. So I assist women with obesity, food shame, and anxiety. And I found low carbohydrate dieting in 1999 and did a sort of 5-year stint there. But what I discovered at that point was that there was very little information aimed at the UK. In fact, there was actually no information aimed at the UK. It was all coming out of the States. And one of the most confusing things that then has actually led me on this journey is our labelling laws versus the US's labelling laws. Because I started with Dr. Atkins' New Diet Revolution. A friend at work gave me the book and said, have a go at this because it's fantastic. And of course, chapter 5 of that edition is all about how you subtract fiber and so it's all about how you count your carbs. And it was all US information. And so I was merrily doing that. And then one day I walked into Holland & Barrett, picked up a packet of Scan Bran, read the back, did the maths and went, hang on a minute, that's -3 carbs. That can't be right. And from that, it was like, well, if I'm having problems finding proper information, other people are going to be having problems finding this. So I made the Low Carb in the UK website. I then started a Yahoo group and created a community. And at that point, I hadn't at all discovered any form of mindfulness or anything like that. So I very much used what I now see as negative language around the journey. So I would call myself a loser, which if you think about, I'm on a mission in the world to remove the words weight loss from society. And in my Facebook group now, I'm very heavy on the linguistics on people, which does occasionally get me called a headmistress and a teacher and whatever. But I really believe that because weight is non-specific, we don't want to be getting rid of muscles and bones and organs and brains and blood. We want to be getting rid of fat. And of course, loss is universally sad, generally speaking. We lose our keys, we lose money, we lose our way, we lose people. People die. We call that a loss. We can't, and it's that whole, it has a, once you lose something, it tells the subconscious you want to find it again. So linguistically, weight loss is possibly the most unhelpful phrase we could have picked. And so in that first 5 years, my personal journey was I got down, I think I dropped at that point 4 stone, and I got to from, I think I was 18, nearly 19 stone when I started, down to about just under 15. And then because I was just blindly following my carbs and not doing anything else, not thinking about nutrient density, not thinking about how my body was feeling, I was sticking to 22 grams of carbohydrate a day, but the food I was eating was actually stuff my body didn't like, and I gained 2 stone back. I was eating a lot of Dove's gluten-free biscuits with clotted cream on the top. They're only 2 carbs each, and I would have like 3 or 4 of those and various other bits and pieces. And although I was like at my limits, and it was okay. But I wasn't going to lose the faith with it, because I basically was not feeling like death warmed over, because sugar makes you feel rubbish. And I had really good skin. I was sleeping really well. So I had all the other benefits. It was just my body was getting bigger again. And I was also doing nights at that time. So again, that's a whole thing about insulin, cortisol, hormones, things, they get messed up. And that was probably, so between those things, it wasn't in the right place, but I didn't have the learning to actually figure that out at that point. I then was medicated for a completely non-related issue that sent me absolutely batshit crazy, is what I call it. I was given a mini menopause medically, and the only thing I could think of to calm myself down again was sugar. So I started eating potatoes again, because potatoes are my kryptonite. I've never met a potato I don't like. And so I started eating potatoes because they made me feel good. I started eating sugar because it made me feel good in that moment, and it calmed the crazy down. And with what the hormones were doing as well to my body, I put on 3 stone in 3 months. Bang.
Wow.
And then I think I put on another 1 stone in like the year after, because it was a 3-month course, and just my hormones were just so messed up. I don't think I could have avoided it. And it was all visceral fat. It was all, cause I'm an apple shaped person, which I now know means I've got, polycystic ovaries, which is why they medicated me. But they actually said I had endometriosis, which I don't believe I do, because I don't feel like an endo person, if that makes sense. And so I then spent the next sort of 5 years not being ready to give up carbohydrate again, and knowing that it was the best thing for my body and that getting back to it would be a good idea. But I was an addict, and I was in the thrall of my addiction. And it was only in 2010 where... at the end of 2009, I knew I was ready. And then in 2010, my then partner went off to a stag do for 3 days. And that was it. Right, I can change, because I've got to just worry about myself. Steak and cream and fridge and mushrooms and vegetables. And I literally did 3 days of donk. And that was me. And I've sort of been carrying on from there. And then in 2015, I found sort of I'd been sort of wobbling around the edges of the mind stuff since about sort of 2009, 2010. But I really sort of got into that in 2015 and decided at that point that becoming a coach, because I've got like at that point 15 years worth of knowledge in low carbohydrate dieting. I think it was in, yeah, five years ago. So in fact, 2014 is when I moved the Yahoo group to Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
About then was when I started effectively the second bit of the journey to where I am now, around the linguistics and around creating my systems, writing my books. So I wrote my first book, which is tiny, it's like this thick, in 2016. I followed that up I had a brain fart November 2017 to write a book about how you do Christmas. Mm-hmm. So again, there's a 50 page book, it's a workbook book. And that was November 2017 that came out. And then what I call my big book, which I was so surprised I had so many words in me when I actually got a copy of the paperback in my hand. It's like you could beat someone to death with this paperback. It's wonderfully thick and chunky. And that was that released August 2018. And I'm lining up now to write the fourth book, which is going to be on diabetes. So I'm going to be taking a lot of the premises that are in the third book. And the third book is all methodology about how you change your diet painlessly without keto flu, over to a low carb way of living or life. And also then changing your mind around the messaging we get, which I spoke about, like sugar is love, treats is food. I need a glass of wine. All this stuff that we have in our brains that effectively sabotages ourselves if we're not conscious about it. So that you've got part one is food, part two is mind, part three is all of your science. And that was an interesting set of stuff to write, research and whatever. I nearly put a history of low carb in the book, and then I got stuck in the 70s where it's how do you make an argument between Yudkin and Keyes sound interesting, and thought, no, this is just too difficult to write. I'll drop it out of this book and stick it in another thing somewhere. And then the fourth part is the specifically the UK-US differences. So what, like what we call ground almonds is almond flour over there, courgette zucchinis, how they produce their meat versus how we produce our meat, which is very different. And again, all that information that comes out of the US about pasture raised beef, well, all of our, nigh on all of the UK's beef is pasture raised. You don't have to ask for it because we've got a load of hills and a load of grass, whereas the States don't. So they feed their cows corn and soy, which changes their fatty acid profile, which is where all that stuff comes from. So I'm now, as I say, today is my first day of going all in. So I am now full-time award-winning coach, full-time author, full-time helping the world. And I'm so excited to like really get into that and get going. Although I've been doing it, as I say, for the last however long.
That's amazing. It's such an up and down story. And I think a lot of people can relate to that. Congratulations for this being your first day doing it full-time.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I get a bit of guilt because I'm not skinny yet. And one of the things I think about my personal body is I'm not sure I'll ever get thin because I have such a hormonal challenge around the polycystic ovaries. My body hangs onto body fat. But part of my work is accepting myself as I am. And I'm very bone dense, very muscle dense. I've just got a tummy. And we'll go eventually, but I'm also resigned to the fact that it might not, and I'm okay with that. So, but sometimes that gives me you're not skinny. How can you talk to people about this?
Mm. Yeah, that came up recently on Twitter when one low carb doctor said you should never trust a fat doctor giving you nutrition advice. Mm-hmm. And someone else chimed in saying, well, that's not really fair because different people have different health goals, and aiming to be thin does not necessarily mean the same thing as aiming to be healthy.
Mm-hmm. And much.
Yeah, and I know that, I don't know if you follow Georgia Ead online. She's an American psychiatrist and uses nutrition a lot. She she's got some great lines like studies have shown definitively that the head is part of the body. And she also talked about having feelings of guilt and being fraudulent because she was talking about using nutrition for physical and mental health, and found herself gaining a lot of weight, even though she was eating nutrient-dense food and sticking to low carb. So she had to tweak it, you know, again, in terms of fat to protein ratio and even the type of food, you know, because she can't have red meat typically because it's aged. So she has issues with histamines. It can get quite complicated. And you particularly focus on the area of women like yourself trying to work out how to make low carb work when they have like a completely different hormonal landscape to other women and some men. And I know that Amber O'Hearn, who we've had on the podcast, talks about some women actually needing to increase the amount of fat that they're eating in order to lose weight, which is sort of counterintuitive. And also doctors, you know, like Jay Wrigley in America, who does a lot of work with peri and menopausal women, mm-hmm. Around how to tweak what they're doing in mm-hmm. order to make it work for them. And I suppose that's where you are now, is becoming an expert really and sharing that with your clients.
Oh yeah, because at the moment I'm 48, I'm 49 in what, 10 days time. So I am firmly in that perimenopausal barrier myself. So some of the stuff I've discovered for myself, I then find helpful to tell other people about it in terms of tweaking ratios and some supplements that I know I've personally found useful. It's that whole N=1 study. these might work for you too stuff. But I'm also very, very much about your body will be able to tell you what it needs with far more detail than anything we can think about. You can't control your body with your mind. Your body will always win because hormones and enzymes are way more powerful than your thoughts, which is one of the reasons why the standard paradigm fails, because you're hungry. Your body is going, I need food. Give me food. Bah, 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 bah. You can't win against your body. So I'm unless there are specific reasons to be, it's also one of the reasons that I hate being keto. I personally eat a ketogenic diet, but I don't have the being keto mentality. I just eat food. I eat food that is, at the moment, I am 99% of the time I'm being carnivore, and it suits me fantastically. But I'm not worrying about my percentages. I'm not worrying about how much I eat. I eat to hunger. Yeah, I've got three tenets in life. I've got, if you are hungry, eat food, not junk. If you are not hungry, stop eating or don't eat, depending on where you are. So that applies at the end of the meal. And of course, some people have the whole, there were starving children in Africa, people that grew up at my definitely, that was a big thing in our childhood. People are starving in Africa. You have to eat all your food. So there are big problems with that. So that's why sort of tenet two is don't eat or stop eating. And tenet three is make every mouthful you eat as optimal as possible, given the circumstances you find yourself in. Because sometimes there is no optimal option. So don't have the guilt, which is where you also, I think from the being keto attitude, there's a lot of guilt piled on you about if you have something that is not keto. Oh my God, some of the groups on Facebook are full of like judgmental piling on, you've been appalling. Blah. And it's like, no, I'm not of that way of thinking at all. If I want to eat cake, I will choose to eat cake and I will own the choice and I will either enjoy it or not, depending on if it was good cake or not. But most of the time, I'm not going to make that choice because why would I poison myself? But the fact that I'm an adult making an empowered choice through knowledge rather than emotion or I deserve it or whatever, it really, again, that's part of the way I get people to, I assist people to change their mindsets, because that whole food keeps us small. We give food the power in the current paradigm rather than us having the power to choose to eat it.
Where do you think that guilt and shame comes from, and why do you think food has so much power over us these days?
I actually think a lot of it is to do with, and it's not just these days actually, I did a bit of research around how long we've been using weight as a judgment, and it's actually 4,000 years. So by telling people don't use the scales, use a tape measure instead, because the scales will do this as you go down your journey and they are no good for anything but a long-term trend marker, getting people off of that, and it's almost the scales are almost an addiction for some people because they need that short-term validation, and then they get really depressed when it goes up and then they get really joyful when it goes down, and it's like roller coaster of emotion. But there's a lot to do about these days, the media and photoshopping bodies, men and women, and that whole fat is seen as a worthless thing, I want to say. Fat people sometimes make assumptions around fat people's intelligence, fat people's, they think, the butt of jokes. A large amount of comedy is still the expense of the fat man. Although I watched which one's, it's the latest Avengers where Thor gets fat.
Mm.
It's just a fat joke. And it's stuff like that. This very subtle in society, and so we have this. And again, part of the current paradigm is you have to get thin at the expense of your body. Because, of course, the current paradigm rips away muscle, rips away bone, as well as getting rid of some of your fat, but not in efficient ways. So you end up with this sickly, ill, weak body. And that's normal. So women are supposed to be waifly thin and have no muscles at all. And on the flip side of that, men are supposed to be these muscle bound, tall, slightly hairy things. And it's all just the image. But if you go back, I don't know if you've ever looked at, which idea am I going to talk about there? Go backwards first. So if you go backwards and look about the image, look at like paintings and the images of people, we've always been very image obsessed. We've very much controlled the shape of people. If you think about corsets, if you think about, you can like look at centuries and the silhouettes of women and the silhouettes of men, around the way that we styled ourselves and the way we emphasized our curves and men's muscles. And these days you then think about that whole being weak as a normal, and it's just not helpful. And it's wrong. We are not supposed to be weakly. We are supposed to be vital. We're dynamic engine, or we're dynamic machines meant to move long distances slowly, run away from predators fast, and lift heavy things in the course of doing stuff. And the modern way of just sitting, and again, being sedentary, and I'll put my hand up there, I'm way more sedentary than I personally would know would be good for my health, although I'm less sedentary than I was a while back, because my body now wants to move more, because as I've gone along my journey, you get more energy because your energy is being liberated from ketones, my body fat, and I'm less heavy, so my body wants to move more. So again, part of the journey of my acceptance of me is allowing myself to do as much exercise as my body wants to do. And I think that we just have this whole big judgment around you should be that, and it's that should of course is a negative, because it's the thing that I have to do, but I don't want to do. And so society's messaging is just shoulding all over us. You should be thin. You should have long hair. You should have perfect skin. You should have stick thin arms and legs if you're a woman. You should have big muscly ones if you're a man. And it's all shoulds. You should be this. This is the model to follow. Whereas your body is what shape your body is. And no one, even I don't know if you ever saw the video on YouTube, even Sally Gifford can't be Sally Gifford. So they photoshopped a model. So basically they did a photo shoot with her. She's sort of lying down with her hands like this on her body, and then her body goes like that and her legs up. And then they photoshopped it. So they made like her stomach smaller, her legs slightly longer, her face, they did makeup and whatever. I think they altered her hair slightly as well. And you see them as they Photoshop it, and she just turns into this thing that she doesn't actually look like what ended out. Mm-hmm. Even Sally Gifford cannot be Sally Gifford. And it's that sort of thing that is now very, very damaging. So before the wonderful technology we now have, when somebody painted a picture of you, well, that was the truth, maybe, because artists probably took liberties. They Photoshopped in their own way. But the bodies that we see in portrait paintings are realistic, whereas some of the bodies we now see are just not realistic. I love the fact that I watched the Try Guys on YouTube quite a bit, and they did a photoshopping themselves dressed as women. So they were recreating female shots, and then they did recreating male shots. And there's one of the Try Guys is called Eugene, and he is a very handsome Asian man. The other three are white, typical American. I think Ned is the next handsome one. So basically they have a standard of look. And Eugene looks at his own male Photoshop picture, and basically it's one where the abs are out and he's in like a back arch position. And he says to the camera, "My immediate thought is I'm too fat in that picture." And it's really, really not. And at that point he was thinking, well, yeah, I'm never going to be comfortable with my body. Even if that is the perfection, the idealistic, I still think that's too fat. It was like a mind expanding thing for him. He's been given all this messaging about, he's not at all fat. He's very athletic. He's a dancer. And when you get stuff like that going on in his brain, well, that's going to be everyone's brain. So we are fighting against a tide of complete non-reality, which is why I accept the way I am, because I could never be, I'm 5'10", but I could never be a model because I'm the wrong shape, and I've always been the wrong shape. And even when I got very slim, I got down when I was 18 or so, I did Weight Watchers and I got down to 12 stone, and I still had a curvy belly, and it was like, this is slender for me. I could never be a model. And so why would I aspire to being that? And I didn't understand then about, well, actually it's because of other bits and pieces. But yeah, it's all about this impossible goals for us to reach.
Yeah, there's this kind of tension between self-acceptance and self motivation to change for the positive. So there, you know, I've spoken to a few people on the podcast about fat shaming and the atmosphere around acceptance and this acknowledgement that holding up unrealistic ideals causes distress to people. And that's the whole idea. You know, you drive people's aspiration to look like the model, and the model's unattainable. You know, the model's shape is quite likely to be unattainable. Like you say, people have different size frames. They've maybe been overweight to the point that actually they're going to find it very difficult to reset their kind of weight set points in a healthy way that will get them down to a really skinny weight. And that's just the way it is. And I think we're all kind of trying to work out how to be encouraging towards people who want to make healthier choices, but at the same time not judge them for how they've looked in the past, how they look now, and how they're likely to look in the future. And it's a really delicate thing. I think whenever, you know, I share something about diet, some people get profoundly irritated by it. It doesn't matter what it is, because when you share something about diet, it's very personal, and there's this implication that people assume you mean they should do what you're saying. And it's tough. I think the only way you can get the only way I found to get around it is just by kind of, you know, being the change I want to see in the world, and sharing with people what I've gone through. And you know, that speaks for itself. And if people want to find out more, then they can, and they very often do. So I think for every person who unfriends me, there's probably one or two who get in touch on private message to say, you know, how can I do what you've done.
Point about fat shaming, part of the problem with fat shaming is, again, where we come from, the current paradigm, because the diet that we're told to eat for the people that get fat, and have you heard of Dr. Richard McCanus?
No.
So he wrote a book in 1958. I love the older books. I think they're fantastic. Definitely some of them are the product of their time. But he named the two types of body. You've got Mr. Burns Everything and Mr. Fattens Easily. And it's the way that they treat carbohydrates. So the Mr. Burns Everything are the people that can eat junk food and stay thin. And then the Mr. Fat and Easy, of course, they're the people that look at a donut and get fat. Mm-hmm. And so the fat shaming, I think, also mostly comes from thin people who are Burns Easilies. And they said, well, you just have to eat less and then you'll get thinner. And you can't not get thinner if you don't eat less, because the current paradigm is that's what it says. The first law of thermodynamics. You can't break that. But your body is not a bomb calorimeter. And it completely then forgets about the second law of thermodynamics, which is a system tends to fall into chaos. And that's where the hormonal stuff comes. And I am going into calorie theory. Calorie theory is utter rubbish, because again, the body is not a bomb calorimeter. We use hormones and enzymes to digest. We don't burn food. So we treat the three macronutrients in very different ways, and we don't use all of them for energy. So this whole you have to eat less and move more rubbish, it doesn't work. The way your body is set up and the way your body processes, whether you're a burns easily or a fat, or a burns everything or a fattens easily, has a massive thing. And of course the fattens easily people, they're trying to eat less, their bodies are protesting, they're making themselves sicker by trying to stick to this eat less paradigm, and then they get shamed for not being able to eat less and suffer hunger and suffer deprivation and get told they are they become victims of the system. And it's oh yeah, you don't have enough willpower to not do that. There's nothing to do with willpower. It's the fact that as I said earlier, you will always lose against your body, because it wants food and it will tell you it. And if you're not eating the right food and enough food, yeah. So yeah, the fat shaming thing all is tied into the current pattern. And I think when we finally shift, and I liken it like to a cruise ship, it takes forever for the boat to turn around, so it's not a snap turn. And I think when I started, we were, if turning around is up here, we were down here, we were merrily steaming along in the current paradigm. I think now we're about here. I don't think we've tipped yet. Mm-hmm. But with the NHS now starting to say that low carb for diabetics or for people with diabetes is the way to play, that's a major key. And with Asim Mahotra, Dr. Unwin, Dr. Harkham, just doing the good things to government, I think we're going to do that. And once the paradigm shifts, I also think fat shaming will go away to a certain extent. But again, that will take a longer time because people are people. Because when people realize that it's fat people are not greedy, fat people are not lazy, fat people are not whatever you want to pejoratively call them, it was actually the hormones all along and the type of food we were eating. And it's not their fault. It is their responsibility, but it's not their fault that they got fat. I think that it will naturally, I don't think it will ever go away, but I think that the way that that happens will change and it will become less judgmental. But then that also could be me just being very, very optimistic.
No, I think you're right to have optimism. And I think I'd certainly agree with you that the center point of the optimism for me is around the fact that doctors are adopting it left, right, and center. And I think you get a lot of noise run by people, companies who have an interest in people not sorting out their food addiction. So it's pretty clear that, you know, you have PR agencies running stories about how keto, the fad diet, can't work and it's dangerous. But then on the other hand, you have well-established... Sorry?
Keto crotch. That was a complete fabrication. Yes. Of a marketing.
Yeah, what a load of rubbish.
Yeah.
And then, cause, you know, you've got loads of well-established, published scientists who are also clinicians who work with patients day in, day out, and have been taught by their patients, like you mentioned, Dr. David Unwin, who are saying that low carb is safe, that it works really well for a lot of people, and that it's actually the best way that they've found to control appetite, which is the key part, I think, of understanding why calories in, calories out is not a very useful way of thinking about weight.
I'm very pro energy balance. So I completely admit, if you eat too much food, you will gain weight. But it's not to do with the calorie content. It's literally to do, again, this is where I'm very, very into, when your body tells you you are satisfied, which when you're eating a low carb diet is a very different feeling to carb stuffed.
Yeah.
And people come at it and they're like, and they've learned that fullness means their belly hurts. And it's relearning that, well, yeah, I've had enough food now. I did the other with my leaving do last week at work. I had a team leaving do, and we went to a curry house. So I had like the plate of curry and of course no rice or whatever. And as I ate the last piece of meat off of the sauce, my body went, you're full now. And I looked down at the plate and went, oh, and I've eaten all of the meat. How fantastic. It's as I've run out of food, I am full. And it was just a really, really happy making thing. The whole, oh yeah, okay, that's cool. And because I'd look down to see if I'd got much left, and it's like, oh, you're nice. But it's that learning that sense of, yeah, I am satisfied. I need to eat no more food. Which, when you've got a whole bunch of stuff in here about food is love, and again, people that have deprivation dieted tend to have problems with controlling, with pushing past that point, because there might not be any more food. So they hoard, and they're hoarding in their bodies. They're excessively eating because in the back of here, they've been taught horrifically that they can only have so much and there won't be any more. And so I have to eat all of this stuff. And so some of the work I'm doing is basically gently unknotting that and going, well, yeah, if there's still stuff on your plate, just put it in the fridge and eat it later. It's not going to be a problem. Just stick it in the fridge. And then you've got a snack if you need one for later. It's no big deal. So that definitely, the energy balance thing, I will completely agree with everyone that if you eat too much food, you will get fat. But I'm, again, completely against using calories as the judgment of that. I'm very pro using your body to tell you that. Because your body, as I say, it will work it out way better than you ever could. And it will tell you if you listen to it.
Yeah, for sure. You picked up on a couple of things that I want to talk about. One of them is food is love. And the other one was that there's been some sort of shame around food that you're aware of for 4,000 years. So what's the evidence that you've seen that it's that old?
One of the books I read around, what's it, Corsets and Something, it was about female shape.
Yeah.
And it was talking about, so that lady did a whole bunch of more research than I'd done. And she discovered stuff in Aristotle's work around weight specifically as the measure of a man. So we've had this concept, literally the concept of how heavy you are is how good you are as a person for 4,000 years. So my thing about getting rid of weight loss as words, I am very, very appreciative that it's a very, very large job. And it's possibly one that I won't win, because they are the words are so ingrained. But people, when people look at you, and one of the worst things I think we've done to ourselves is conflate weight and size. So nobody, when somebody looks at someone who's dropped a ton of fat, and they don't say, "Oh my God, you look so much slimmer." They go, "Oh my God, you've lost so much weight." Because we've conflated size and weight, and it's not great for our psyches, because it puts weight as the king. But of course, body composition is way more important than your weight. As I say, I've got very good bone density, very good muscle density because of the way I eat. I suspect if I was a low calorie dieter, I know at the same, when I was younger, at the same size, I was around 2 stone lighter than I am right now. I was 2 stone heavier that way around, because I'm more dense. So because I have muscle and bone density, I am heavier than potentially someone.
It makes sense.
You know what I mean?
When you focus on nutrient density and you quite often people talk about emphasizing not your weight but your waist circumference, which is a better proxy for how healthy you are than your weight, because you might put you might put on weight but lose inches around your waist because your muscle and bone density is increasing, because the quality of the food you're eating is increasing, so your body thinks, well, I'll use this to bolster what I have.
Absolutely.
In a healthy way.
Yeah, I have my piece of string that is my height, and at the moment I'm about that far away from my waist circumference being the same as my height.
Brilliant.
So I'm an apple person, so it's all carrying there, but it's I'm like that far away from my goal, essentially.
Yeah.
As opposed to being 4 stone away from where society say I should be.
Yeah. And BMI is not a great thing. If you're
BMI is horrendously horrible.
If you're working out, then you can find people who look like Michelangelo's David, but would fail the BMI test.
Yeah. Yeah. Any strong athletes, rugby players, weightlifters, any American footballers, whoever, people that have to maintain muscle mass to do their sport are all obese. But they're not. There's madness.
Yeah. Yeah. People look for, I suppose, quick ways of understanding what's healthy and what's not, and the actual message can get lost in translation. Yeah, you talked about food is love, and I know that, you know, you see videos getting shared where it shows like old chocolate bars and variety boxes from Christmas, and the idea is just to bring back nostalgic feelings for people, and it definitely does for me. You know, it just seems so strange and arbitrary that I've got a strong emotional bond to chocolate products that are branded in a particular way that, you know, from my childhood. Like, you name it, any of the main manufacturers, I look at those bars and I think about good times that I had. But I've been tricked. Yeah. I've been tricked by very clever marketing and branding. And it's funny because, you know, I would binge on sugary things. I would binge on things that had refined flour and veg oil in them. But access to these foods and marketing of these foods is not restricted in the slightest. Sugar is starting to be taxed a little bit, and there's starting to be a little bit of noise around excess sugar and obesity. But it's not like smoking where you have to ask for cigarettes. They're covered, they're unbranded, there's health warnings on them. All these amazing things that have been done around harmful poison that is cigarettes. Yet you find that that food is not subject to the same control. And, you know, maybe you could expand on what the food is love thing means to you and where you think a solution might be in terms of that availability of that sort of food.
Well, I don't know if you've read Gary Tobes' The Case Against Sugar, just to pick up on your cigarette branding thing before we go into Food is Love. Oops.
I've read reviews of it. I've not read it itself.
It's one of those books that makes you go, because there's just this whole bunch of coincidence. The tobacco industry and the sugar industry were actually working hand in hand for a lot of the 50s, 60s and 70s. And they put sugar into tobacco because tobacco is bitter and it burns your throat, and sugar makes the burn go away.
Yes, it made that, for the first time, it made it deeply inhalable.
Yeah. And so but I think where we are with cigarettes in terms of their health, if you look back at the advertising for cigarettes and the fact that doctors used to tell patients to inhale because there could be health benefits.
Mm.
And with sugar, we are still very much at the, it's just a calorie stage.
Mm-hmm.
And I was very excited by when Dr. Lustig went onto Ivor Cummings' podcast, and at the very end he was talking about the experiment they did with the kids where they took all of the sucrose out of a junk food diet and replaced it with starch and then gave it to 10 children, and calorie for calorie they were identical diets, but there was no fructose in that diet at all, and all of the kids got more healthy in terms of their blood markers, in terms of their size, in terms of all the things you would measure health by. And he then saying, we found that the metabolite, that methylglyoxalol, that is specifically toxic. And so that's like, we've only just discovered that.
Mm.
Whereas we discovered that smoking is a causal factor to lung cancer, 40 years ago? So we've now probably got 30, 40 years of the message catching up before sugar is the same. We now view it the same way as tobacco now, which is both hopeful and depressing, because it's going to take time. But now we've got the solid science around, yes, sugar is specifically toxic. It's I think that's a really big silver bullet to changing things. But the food equals love stuff, that's all mindset stuff. So I'm personally a huge fan of becoming the detached observer. So in the part two of my book, I talk about the 10 keys to unlocking your mind. And it's all for me about being able to reconcile that there are three things going on in here. There is my body, my mind, and myself. And that's the Aristotelian version of the soul, not the Abrahamic version. It's basically you have a essential spirit, a genius that drives your journey through life. And the fact that we can think about our thoughts, metacognition, means that we are not our thoughts. We are a self that has thoughts. You pick those thoughts up and you analyze those thoughts, and you then start to develop you can make choice. So most people don't realize they are not their thoughts. They just have their thoughts, they go through their days, and essentially are trapped in that whirl of stuff that the inner critic that just tells us we're crap and rubbish and whatever we are, that bad messaging that goes on in there. And we'd never let anyone speak to us the same way we speak to ourselves. Although I think I'm very blessed in the fact that my inner critic doesn't tell me I'm horrible. My inner critic actually asks me to hide a lot. So this is a big deal for me, being able to get visible, going against my inner critic that says, no, you might, I have a tendency for catastrophic change. I am an all-in person, catastrophic change is effectively one of my superpowers, and it's very frightening because I break things. So no, I need to hide and not catastrophically change things. And that's the voice that goes on in the back of my head. So I count myself lucky that I don't have someone calling me fat and ugly all the time, because I don't. But I know a lot of people do. So being able to pick that message up and say, but that's not allowing me to do what I want. That message for me is not allowing me to show up and serve the world and stop the UK eating itself sick. I think that's my goal for the next couple of years. That message isn't helpful to that. And the messages that are in there, of course, the food equals love. The food itself is not the love. The act of your big person, because of course we get all this stuff when we're really small, between 0 and 7. So that your big people gave you love by giving you food. They didn't give you, it's not the food equals love, it's actually that they loved you. And being able to analyze that message, you go, well, yeah, it's the fact that they were showing love in the way that they've been taught to show love. People talk about like their dads giving them sweets when they've been good. Being good, they deserved a treat. And all that stuff about that reinforces all of that messaging. But if you can then pick that messaging up and go, but yeah, it was just my dad loving me. It was just my dad being my dad. And that was the way he'd been taught, and his dad probably taught, his mum had taught, and da, 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 going back. And that was the way that was the model of love. But because we can think about our thoughts, we can change our models. And yes, the old models will still be there, and they will. Inner critic never ever shuts up. But being able to go, well, yeah, you're saying that, but it doesn't matter because I want to do this. And I often have conversations with myself or with my mind. So myself has a conversation with my mind, getting very, very about, well, yeah, what's going on here? Why I have at the moment a real phone phobia. I don't want to call someone and interrupt their day, whereas to do what I need to serve, I need to show up, I need to talk to people. So I'm looking at that in an observer way and going, but that's not helpful for me helping people. So I look at that and go, and it's not one I've conquered yet, but it's the whole one of my jobs for this afternoon is texting people to say, hey, can we have a conversation? Because that's my first step into, I'm not interrupting your day, I'm not. Because my phone lives on silent, I never pick it up. Because I control it, it doesn't control me. I can get into a whole bunch about things about the way we now live with our smartphones. That's not a topic for there. But again, you could say, because sometimes the proxy of this has become love, because this is where we have our relationships. But that again, it's all messaging, and it's all fascinating stuff. I love the way that the brain works, because sometimes it's so beautifully unhelpful. But once you can start analyzing how beautifully unhelpful your mind has become, you can make different choices. You won't always make an optimal choice, but you have the ability to say, yeah, this is what I think and this is how I feel, but what do I want? I want to do this, and it's gonna hurt, or it's going to feel wonderful, but that doesn't matter. This is what I need to do. Focusing on what you want.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. You know, I think along the journey I've taken, there's been a lot of psychological challenges. And what I've found with the difference between mind and self is that I picked up on the self bit before I picked up on the food. Mm-hmm. And so I got into things like meditation and anxiety management because I had really bad anxiety and had low mood and I had ADHD. And so meditating really helped with all that. And anxiety management, you know, I could, I was known to catastrophize. And so, you know, I would use techniques like thinking, what is the worst that could happen? And then thinking, and then pushing that to an absolute extreme, and you end up really with quite a funny situation on your hands. You think, well, okay, so if that's the worst that can happen, then maybe it will. It's out of my control. Yeah. And the meditation stuff, I really liked what you said about feeling separate from your thoughts and that your thoughts aren't you. And that's a very important distinction. So I always imagined it like when I meditated a lot, that my thoughts, any thought that came along was like a fish and that I could pick it out of the water and look at it. And if I didn't like it, then I could put it back in the water and just let it go. And that was very powerful for me because I had a lot of thoughts that were extremely negative, scary, unpleasant, happening all the time. And what happened when I changed the way I ate was that actually changed everything upstream of these thoughts. So whereas I was having to come up with psychological techniques to do as best I can to mitigate the damage that these dreadful thought patterns were doing, when I changed the way I ate, they just went away. So I was left with some stuff in the background, but I found that by changing my mind through food, myself had to do hardly any work anymore. It was brilliant. Everything just quietened down. The system was well regulated, and I wasn't nearly as confused about what it all meant as before. It's remarkable. And you know, there's anecdotes all over the place about this happening in all sorts of conditions like anxiety, depression, Amber O'Hearn with her bipolar. It's great. And I think for me, the food is love thing. I love what you say there about, you know, detaching the idea that food is love from the fact that people who gave you that food loved you. It's not the same thing. Yeah. I think that's brilliant.
Not at all. Picking up on your points about your upstream change.
Yes. I mean,
physiologically, that's all about what happens when you eat sugar. You excite what's called GABA, which is a big, long chemical word. And when you take away the sugar and start eating more healthful, you emphasize glutamate, so GABA is a brain exciter, and glutamate is a brain calmer downer. I can't remember the proper medical word for brain calmer downer. And there's a lot of, again, anecdotal coming out with people that are autistic, where their brains are wired the way they are, and you cannot ever cure it, but by removing the excitation of GABA and allowing glutamate to come up more, they can get out from underneath their specific wiring and actually shine. And again, as you say, there's the whole bunch about depression and anxiety and inflammation in the brain. So of course, again, sugar, a carb heavy diet is very pro-inflammatory. And there's a lot of really nice research coming out that says depression in particular is caused by brain inflammation on some levels, not everything, but if you take away the inflammation, you get less depressed if you are someone that is prone to that. So I definitely, that whole, again, it comes back to, I think it was Hippocrates with the whole let medicine be thy food and food be thy medicine. If you eat stuff that we evolved to eat, you get healthy. And a lot of the things I serve, the level I serve on, people come at me for weight loss, but it's all about health. And so people that are in my group, they've just started and they're going, well, it's my the scales aren't moving fast, because of course we've been conditioned that they should go like a rocket. And if they aren't, then you're failing. Mm-hmm. In terms of that, it's that whole, but yeah, your body has been, especially if you've been a serial low fat dieter, your body's been consistently stripped of bone muscle, stripped of essential bits of you, and it's getting healthier again. It is rebuilding itself from the ground up, and getting healthier. It's not ditching your fat yet, because being healthy is a priority over being slender to your body. So there's a whole bunch of stuff there around, again, with the conditioning around weight, that we should be going fast. And it's like, no, your body needs to go at the speed your body goes. And by doing that, you are getting healthier. You're helping your brain to get healthier, because you're giving it wonderful fats that build itself. It's a protein fatty matrix. You're reducing inflammation, which again is removing those things around anxiety, depression, ADHD, autistic behavior that's emphasized by brain excitation. And it's just all round, food can fix you. And we medicate all of these things that we medicate around. Mostly, if you just stop putting in the thing that causes the problem, it goes away. But there's no money in not eating wheat and sugar, really, is there? So no one will ever, I say this with a very, very sarcastic tone of voice, no one is ever going to promote low carb, because it loses a whole bunch of people money. And I think that's part of the current fight. The current fight is people are going, well, yeah, this makes me healthy. Whereas the people that want to earn money out of us are going, but no, it has to be wrong. You can't do this. You have to keep paying us, because we're going to keep you trapped in the paradigm that you're currently trapped in. People will win eventually, but no one's ever going to promote in terms of money. But then you get the people that make the junk food for keto people. And that's just as bad as normal junk food. It's junk food.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You get people who, you know, will fit with your carb goals, but it's not actually got any nutrition in it. Yeah, you picked up on a couple of interesting points there. There's someone that I suggested low carb might work for, and they tried it and they were losing a couple of pounds a week. They were eating until they were full. They were eating nutrient dense foods, and they couldn't take the fact that it was only a couple of pounds a week they were losing, and that, you know, it would take a year or two to get to where they wanted to be. So there's definitely an education piece that is ongoing.
Well, I think my message at that point to people that say that is, well, it took you however many years of your life to get fat. You are not going to get thin overnight.
Yeah, absolutely.
You can't instantaneously undo a lifetime of metabolic damage. Just don't work like that.
Yeah.
But again, as you say, some people don't like that, because we've been, the current society we live in, some of the messaging we get is instant satisfaction on everything, which for this, the body is not the way it works. It's not helpful. Some society as a whole has lost the ability to be patient and to just sit and to be. And we've lost that moment, because everything is now. You can binge watch on Netflix. You can order food and it's there in 45 minutes. You get, everything is now very instant.
Yeah. How do you find the difference between men and women when it comes to low carb coaching?
I haven't coached many men. But men tend to think of men tend to think of things more straightforwardly. I've been doing some research around pain recently, and one of the studies reasons that women get less pain treatment than men is because women tend to be rather narrative around what they do, whereas men are very direct and factual. So they get more pain medication because they appear more urgent, whereas women don't. We've been again, part of it's being socialized to self-negate. But we don't give as big an impression. So when it comes down to coaching the differences between men and women. You have to meet everyone where they are. And there's not that much difference, but it's about using different modeling. So a model I might use with a woman would vary to a model I might use with a man in terms of the way they then understand it and the model of the world that they use. And that's the pretty much is the men tend to be very, I can see it, I can do it, but hang on to it. Because women are a bit more cooperative and collaborative. So the models I would use there is more around, well, who have you got to help you accountable, like that cooperation model. So you've got a buddy, whereas men are more comfortable doing stuff on their own and being held accountable by like one person rather than a group, I've found. But
yeah, that makes sense.
It's not major league, it's not big, but it's more, I think it's sometimes more about the person, because I work or worked as of today, it's definitely worked. I worked in IT. I have, I believe, like an ambivalent brain. I can think both ways. So I'm very good at leaning into a male model of thought because that's what I've had to do for the last 30 years in my career. So I'm very into logic. I'm very into systems thinking. My main superpower is what I call connecting the dots. So I can look at what's going on and go, right, there's all this going on. That's where we need to focus because that bit there is the problem. That's where we're having issues. We need to fix that bit and then everything else will fall into place. But because of, I have a lot of lateral thought. I can think around things, which is why I think I can look at a gestalt thing and go, well, no, we need to look in there because I'm looking laterally around what's going on. So I think my brain has blessed me with being able to see both sides and being able to use either model quite well. So I don't tend to have any problems talking to either one, but I am very good at meeting them where they are to give them the help they need.
Yeah, that makes sense. It's interesting you talk about, you know, being accountable and a communal thing. You know, I did a video about the problem with traditional weight loss companies like Weight Watchers and Slimming World that focus essentially on calories and that something they get right is that they encourage people to meet up. And I think what they get wrong with the meetups is the weighing in. I think that's grotesque. But I think meeting up to talk about what works is an excellent idea. And I know that you've taken part in keto and low carb meetups in London. And I wonder if you could talk about them and, you know, how many people were there, how did they work, and were they useful, do you think?
Well, I know what, for one thing, Weight Watchers and Slimming World, I'm actually now I am me and focusing on changing the world. I'm going to start a diet club. It's called Low Carb Living UK, and it's going to sort of use the meeting up model of Slimming World, Weight Watchers, but it's going to be Weight Watchers and Slimming World basically create customers from themselves because they want. Slimming World recently changed the way they advise you to eat because it gives you a slower result. Therefore, they get money for you from longer, which I think is absolutely disgusting. Brilliant business strategy.
Yeah.
Not great for us. So my aim with the customers that will come through is make sure that they're educated to make optimal choices, that they get nutrient density, that we have like the reverse lecture thing where we can do questions and answers. They do a measuring, not a weigh-in, like once a month. So getting us away from the scales, and they walk away and I never see them again, which theoretically is a bad business model, but I don't think we're going to run out of customers for a while. But that my aim is to create that non-judgmental space in real life rather than online. But in terms of keto meetups, I've only actually been to one and I spoke at it. Yumsy down in Greenwich, where I live in Blackheath. It's at the bottom of the hill from me. And the owner invited me along to talk. And so I did, but there was about 35 people there. So I sort of spoke for about 2 hours. It was a Q&A session, really fun. And then we socialized afterwards in the shop. And it was just really nice to talk to people about where they are. It's that whole joint struggle thing. One problem shared is a problem halved. If you can actually talk to someone about what's going on, even if you don't get an answer, you feel better. And then that will then enable you to keep going. And so I think where people, we are social animals. We aren't, again, the whole isolation of this thing. We are, our brains don't work as lone things. We are not, we are pack, we are herd. And it takes a bit, all of the trite things around people gathering in groups. But the reason for that is because we work better in collaborative spaces. And one of the problems with the world right now is we are in a very, very masculine energy. And masculine energy is about go-getting, individualism, winners, losers. And we are very, very much in that energy. Whereas finding more of a balance and also coming towards feminine energy, and I'm not talking about males and females, I'm talking about the energies behind them, going towards cooperation and shared goals, win-win.
It might be kind of similar to Ian Gilchrist's book about left brain and right brain, the master and his emissary, you know, where you've got the left-hand side is obviously they both do many things, but both sides do many things, but the, like you're talking about, the seeing something and acting on it there and then to master it, to win. And then the emissary being the right side, which is those softer skills, which we can de-emphasize if the winning bit is over-incentivized.
Yeah, it's not a book I've read, but I'll go and look that one up actually, because that sounds like a fascinating read. Yeah, it definitely is about being able to give in and share, I think are the words I want to say around that. Because when you are supported and you feel part of a community, you will achieve more. Often people, when I have a coach, an initial chat call, and I ask them who's going to hold them accountable to this decision they make about what they're going to do. They then say me, in a very enthusiastic and happy voice. And it's like, well, no, because if you rely on yourself, you're less likely to actually get your goal than if you have someone supporting you. And whilst self-motivation is key and it's absolutely integral, you can only get you so far. One of the things I've learned in the last year or so is to talk more. I previously was a very great listener, and I would listen to people and not talk a lot about myself. But I've learned in the last year that I learn the most about myself when I'm talking about myself and my stuff. Because once you get it out of here, where it's just like in the dark and whirling around, once you actually verbalize it, and writing works the same way, once you get it out and verbalize it, you can then pick it up and go, oh, that's an interesting thing. Wow, that's a really good idea. But you can't do that on your own. So by just having that community that you can talk about yourself with, I personally think is a fantastically, it's a pillar to success, I feel, in anything, not just the body and fat dropping. It's a pillar of success in life.
Yeah, that makes sense. It's a great plus of the internet is that, you know, I've talked about it before, that in the past when you had people like Banting, who wrote the pamphlet on getting rid of starchy foods to lose weight, and who knows how many other pamphlets were written like that by people who discovered that if you eat low carb then you can keep it at good weight. But we won't know, because they could have been extremely localized, you know. There might have been hundreds of doctors who'd found that out over the ages. And now, though, we can all find each other online and describe to each other what works, what doesn't work, and compare notes. That's the positive side. The negative side is that you end up in ideological fights with people who have different priorities. And, you know, I'm not sure if you've had much of that, if you've seen much flare up on your Facebook group, and how you deal with that.
We've definitely had a couple of those. Mostly again around my language basically in the group is called Rule Three. So Rule Three is about using ditching, dropping, burning fat rather than weight loss. And nothing is naughty, shameful, guilty, whatever. It is your choice. And also Rule Two is about no judgment. And so the arguments tend to be around, again, as I say, me being called a schoolmistress, being called a Nazi once. That was fun. I got called the C word the other day. Oh. That was fun. But it generally seems to be about, and it's like, well, that just means that the message I'm doing and the people that love it, because there was lots of defense of that in the group, it's like, well, if you don't like it, go away. Haters are going to hate. And the more haters I have, actually means my message is being received by the people that need it and love it even better. I'm not standing in the middle trying to serve everyone and then serving no one at all. And I know not everyone will resonate with me, and that's fine. The fact that I have things to say in my particular way, it's being received well by the people that love me. That's all I can hope for. But yeah, it doesn't happen very often, because my group is full of wonderfully supportive people. Lots of people always say, oh yeah, it's the best group on Facebook. It's so supportive in here. There's no judgment in here. And me and the moderator team, we work really hard to maintain that tone, to make sure that, and lots of new, like we've come to let people in batches, and we have we now have an introductory post around, please read the rules. There is no judgment in here. Because people are going to come in, and about every 6 months I have to do a post about new people coming in. They're going to be in the old judgmental paradigm, but the only way that we can help them is by being the light and not being judgmental, and people bend and then relax into the group, and it calms, it sort of bubbles up and then calms down again. So, but again, it's people are people, and people have their attitudes, and there's not much you can do about that. I think one of the things in the group I've given like a tools for people to use is, if you read something a certain way, it's because you've put the inflection on the words, because written words are 7% of communication. The other 93% is nonverbal cues and tonality, and you cannot hear someone's tone when they type something at all. You can only read the words, so you put your own tonality on their words. So something someone could have written in a very light-hearted manner, you read as completely sarcastic, and then you flare up because it's pushed your buttons. Nothing to do with them, it's you. So allowing people to see that people are doing the best they can with the resources they have. Sometimes language is not their resource. Cut everybody some slack. And that's generally the way we deal with it. And it seems to be working.
Yeah, that makes sense. So besides food, what do you think are the most important things that people can do to feel healthy?
Besides food?
Yeah.
Getting outside more. We sit in offices way too much. And one of the things I know I've got to plan in for me in my new life is a walk to work. So basically going out in the morning, having a walk. I live by Greenwich Park, for crying out loud. Going out into green space, breathing the oxygen of the trees. Picking, again, that whole thing of we're meant to walk a lot, run a bit and lift heavy things, that really much sums up, I think. Personally, I'm a huge fan of resistance exercise and yoga and Pilates, so lifting weights. I'm not a fan of cardio, because although it does have some benefits, we are meant to do some running for BDNF and all the stuff that helps your brain. And we need to do some to help our heart get stronger. But it's also very stressful on the body. It causes cortisol. It does a whole bunch of other things that are detrimental. So it's everything in balance. Whereas the resistance exercise is increasing metabolism, because we're increasing our muscle masses, increasing our bone health, because more muscle equals better bone density. So you're preserving yourself against bone issues as you get older, as we naturally start to have a little bit of that stuff going on as we hit the things that I'm now coming into. And so, yeah, it's basically just getting out, yoga, Pilates, lifting some stuff, playing. Mark Sissons has got a really good angle on this, and I really like his attitudes around just get out there and play. We lose how to play as we get adults. And like belly laughing, actually properly laughing at things, is so fantastically therapeutic. And also properly crying at things, allowing ourselves to feel. is a big key for health, rather than, especially you men get it far more worse than us. We're actually allowed to cry, you aren't, in society. But being able to show that big breadth of emotion, that's fantastically good for mental health. And it's also physiologically very good because of the chemicals it then produces in ourselves. So it's about basically just getting a bit more simple, I think, being simplistic, being more outside, being in nature, playing, and just looking after this wonderful, gorgeous engine we've been given to move ourselves around. Knowing that this is an amazing container for ourselves, it produces 1.3 million chemicals that do everything: moods, thoughts, feelings. It's all chemical. It digests the hormones, the enzymes, everything. How the hell did we get here? The accident of evolution that created life. When you start thinking about it on that scale, I'm just so grateful for my body and the fact that it moves me around and it doesn't have too many problems, but I can get around them. And yeah, that's also a really good thing for health, is actually being thankful and grateful to the body you have. Because if you're not, if you're down on yourself and you hate yourself, you're going to have an unhealthy experience in mind and body. So being grateful to yourself, getting out, lifting, playing, moving. That's the best things I think you could ever do for health beyond diet.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think that's a really nice attitude towards it. You mentioned earlier that you're 99% carnivore now. So how do you eat now? What kind of things do you eat?
I eat vegetables to keep my mum happy when I go out with lunch with her. breakfast is usually 3 scrambled eggs, a knob of butter, a trout fillet, and some cream cheese. And that's around midday usually, because I'm pretty much a 2-meal-a-day person now. I'm doing this, I might even try to go OMAD for a bit and see how that goes with my body. And then dinner, which will be normally when I get home, although I don't have to do that anymore. that will then be some form of slow-cooked meat, either lamb or beef. My body doesn't like pork as much as it likes ruminants, I've discovered through this journey. Pork fat tends to leave me a little bit flat, whereas lamb fat and beef fat energize me more. It's basically, I will buy a big thing of slow cooker meat. So like beef shin or beef chuck or lamb ribs or something that I can just chuck in my instant pot now. I used to do it in my slow cooker. And that will do me for like dinners for the week.
Mm-hmm.
I'm the sort of person that doesn't need a lot of variety in my food. And I think that's an advantage for me because I can eat the same thing. I'm never ever going to get bored of scrambled eggs with trout. Oh my God, never. It's fantastic. But I do occasionally get bored especially when I first started carnivore, I was missing broccoli. I love broccoli. And it's like, this doesn't feel like, I haven't even got a word for how it felt. There was something missing. Mm. And although what I was eating was satisfying, immensely satisfying, and my hunger levels totally, completely killed, it was like, yeah, I miss my broccoli. And again, that's about me being then an empowered adult and go, if I want some broccoli, it's not going to kill me. Eat some broccoli. I think one of the things I've now put in as well, and then if I fancy something, if I get hungry at work and so basically eat a dinner or I have breakfast early, then I'll have the sort of the second meal before I go home. If I'm still hungry when I get home, I'll have some yogurt with some cream mixed in and a couple of drops of stevia, and sometimes I'll grate some chocolate into it. And again, that's my, currently with carnivore, you don't really get many things that are pudding shaped.
Mm-hmm.
I found that is the best pudding shape thing if my brain is going, you want something pudding shaped. But it's also quite satisfying in itself because of the level of fat and protein in yogurt and extra fat. Although I actually think I need to dial back on the cream because at the moment my size reduction has stopped moving. Even when I started adding it in, my waist was still going down. But at the moment, it's been about 6 weeks and there's been no movement at all. So I think I need to ditch out the cream again. Obviously for my body it's too much fat, And then you've also got the casein and the A2 and the whole stuff that dairy may be problematic anyway. But I follow, what's his name? Kevin Stock's version of carnivore. So he has a phase one, phase two, phase three. So I am basically at phase one where I'm eating anything that is animal based. Mm. Whereas phase two is just eat ruminant animals and eggs. And then phase three is just eat beef. Mm. And I don't want to be that restrictive with my life. So I'm happy to stay at phase one, quite frankly.
I almost feel like if someone's going to do carnivore to see if it's a decent baseline for their health, then I would do it the other way around, honestly, because an elimination diet really works best when you eliminate everything that you possibly can. Mm-hmm. And I can see how, you know, it's kind of that way around that you just mentioned is kind of similar to how some people approach low carb, in that they, when they first start, they look for substitutes for the junk food they've been eating their whole life. So it's pizza made from either cheese and psyllium husk or cauliflower or whatever, or desserts made from almond flour or, you know, sweeteners all the time. When I first started, it was, I was making optimal diet ice cream in my ice cream maker. So I would use double cream, egg yolks and some Truvia sweetener, and I was maybe having a pint of that every night, and I was losing weight all the time while I was doing it. And I knew that I was getting loads of nutrition in the eggs, and I was eating lots of other healthy stuff at the same time. So, but I don't deal with dairy very well. So I still had skin issues, even though I was losing weight and I felt good. I still had skin issues. When I got to a certain weight, the cream, made me put the weight back on, and it's still like that. If I eat cream, then I get problems with my skin. I can get like a heartburn like reaction, and I start putting on weight. And besides the fat in there, which I don't think is necessarily the problem, because I don't have the same problem with dripping, for example, beef dripping. I think there's hormonal issues with dairy. You know, it's designed to turn a small calf into a massive cow.
Yeah.
It doesn't necessarily mean that is exactly what's going to happen to humans who drink it, but in this N=1 experiment, that's what happens to this human who drinks it.
I found that dairy doesn't give me any, I don't believe dairy gives me any physical problems, but I'm also sort of, the back of my brain goes, well, you're probably And a dairy addict, because I definitely go, I'll never ever not eat cheese. I think cheese is amazing. And I know that the tryptophan in cheese, if I don't eat some, I get sadder, because it's going to be easily available for source of tryptophan. I believe my N=1. But that whole, I've just justified an addiction bomb just there. It's a fascinating thing for me to think, well, yeah, dairy might, if I ditched out dairy totally, could that be the thing that I'm kidding myself? So in 2016, I dropped a Diet Coke habit of 2.5 liters a day that I'd had for about the last 25 years before that. And I did that. I'd spent about 3 years going, yeah, I'm going to give it up. And then not doing it because I was an addict. And I got to the point of, well, there are worse things to be addicted to than Diet Coke. And if there was no Diet Coke in the house, it would be an international Diet Coke crisis. It had an acronym and everything, IDCC. And my then partner at the time made sure that there was my caffeine juice, my addiction. It was actually called my addiction juice, was in the house. And I did not believe how much it was affecting me until I stopped drinking it and I started feeling better. And I sort of wonder, am I at the same place with dairy? Could I feel amazing now I've got my hair is, my nails off. I never used to, I used to bite my nails, and I've now got like nails. Mm-hmm. And they're like rock solid. So am I at a point where I'm justifying eating the dairy because I'm addicted to the whatever proteins that are in cow's milk? And if I stop eating dairy, what will happen? and I'm not at the place where I want to do that yet, which I find hysterical. Again, minds are funny things.
Yeah, I found that, you know, when I got to the point with different types of dairy, you know, I still eat butter sometimes, but I find I do better with beef dripping. But cream,
the butter is so lovely.
It is lovely, yeah.
Amazing.
A lot of things are lovely.
I know.
Cream has its own issues for me, so I have to stay away from it. And cheese is probably the worst because it gives me the most dreadful migraines and affects my mood in a negative way. Mm. So I just decided that it was time to chuck it, and so I don't eat it at all anymore. And I used to love it as well. And when I started crudely with a sort of paleo low carb diet, or paleo light because I was still eating dairy, I found that there was levels of improvement. So first, my weight started to drop and it seemed effortless. I was still eating very rich, delicious foods, and most of my mental health problems went away. Amazing. You know, to first approximation, it was like zero to hero. Yeah. But then as I've refined it, I've made appreciable steps. And I agree with what you said about pork. I don't really eat fatty pork so much now. And it's quite interesting that ruminant fat seems to be a lot more satisfying for people.
Yeah.
Tucker Goodrich, whose episode was just released, and I'm just about to release a second episode with him and Professor Ken Strain, the physics professor, who was my old supervisor, who healed himself from chronic fatigue syndrome, ME. And nice. Their main emphasis is vegetable oils, and that pork fat and chicken fat are equivalent in some ways to vegetable oils because they're monogastrics and can't filter out any of the fats from grains in the same way that ruminants can. And I think they would kind of suggest that one of the main reasons that pork fat isn't as satisfying is because it has the same negative effects on your appetite control as vegetable oils do. And I feel nauseated now when I eat fatty pork some of the time.
I definitely can feel nausea if I eat a lot of pork. But yeah, I'm a great believer in, if society got rid of wheat, sugar and vegetable oils and nothing else, we would all be healthier. But one of the someone posted in the group the other day about new research, the 10 best foods for fantastic health, and pork is at number 8. Oh my god. And as you come down to it, well, because pork is more polyunsaturated, therefore it's seen as healthier. And of course we know that the omega-6s are pro-inflammatory, and yes, you need some, but you don't need tons. And it's that whole, yeah, pork for me is just, I don't really dig the pig. I've been having pork belly every now and then simply because of buying a big chunk of meat. Some weeks it takes up a large amount of budget. So some weeks it has to be pork rather than beef or lamb. But yeah, those weeks are definitely weeks where I have lower energy.
Mm.
And one of the things I discovered, again, you talk about leveling up, that again, where I'd been low carb, solidly, properly low carb for probably 5 years at the point of when I went a carnivore, and I was feeling good, next step, level up, feeling good. And I also, day 32, I thought, okay, let's try and add some stuff back in. And I discovered my belly hates almonds. And I'd been eating almonds every day. And I had like a distended, bloated stomach most every day. And I just thought it was I have a back issue. So one of the drugs I'm on for that causes constipation. So I was just blaming that for the fact I had a really bloated tummy. And when I made myself a low carb chocolate brownie from I Breathe I'm Hungry. And I ate it. And about half an hour later, distended stomach, pain. Oh, my body doesn't like almonds. So I know even if I then went back to what with vegetables, they don't seem to cause me a problem.
Mm-hmm.
But I know that I will never eat nuts again in wholesale. So I ate them the other day when I did the talk at Yumsy. I got some and it's like, yeah. And after that, say, no, that was not worth that. So it's all... yeah, finding out about what's going on and what your body likes. So yeah, there are massively good reasons why pork and chicken. I for a while at lunches at work was a packet of coleslaw, a chucked up baby gem lettuce and half of a chicken mixed, shredded and mixed together. Everyone has said, oh my God, your lunch looks amazing. It's like, it's the most simple lunch to make ever, but it's whatever. But after a while, I started to feel really sick after lunch.
Mm.
And so I swapped the chickens for prawns because at that point I had more money and the nausea just went away.
Mm.
But having done more learning now around the fats, I now completely agree that, yeah, it's making me feel nauseous because it's more like vegetable oil. It's more polyunsaturated. It's not optimal fat for the body. But again, yeah, chicken absolutely. Pork are the cheap sources of meat. So people are going to choose that because of a whole bunch of other reasons around socioeconomic stuff that is out of the range of this podcast.
Yeah, though it is interesting how I think food is one of the things that people expect now to be cheaper and cheaper all the time. And we've kind of lost the connection with the fact that, and I'm not talking about insisting that people buy organic free-range meat all the time or anything. I just mean it's good to accept the fact that healthier food is going to be more expensive than rubbish food a lot of the time. It doesn't always hold true. You get quite a lot of really unhealthy packaged foods that are actually quite expensive. You know, like a Domino's pizza is not cheap.
But very addictive. But the dirt cheap.
Yeah, and but you can, you know, I've actually got a cookbook coming out soon called Low Carb on a Budget.
And, nice.
And so I think it's not going to revolutionize things because everybody knows that meat is more expensive than grains. But I want to educate somewhat to convince people that really you have to start thinking in terms of, you know, unit of currency per unit of nutrition, not unit of currency per calorie.
Yeah. You know,
you'll only get so far thinking like that. Mm. Just like what we were talking about when you maybe first start trying to lose weight and you go to the gym because you think you'll expend more calories, so you've earned a tub of Ben and Jerry's,
yeah,
which has zero nutrition in it. You know, it's about changing minds as well as as well as helping people understand the principles of the how the food works.
100%. And one of the things that, oh, the thought I had as you were in the middle there has completely skipped my brain. You were talking about, oh, that was it, the nutrients, unit of currency to unit of nutrition versus a unit of calorie.
Yeah.
I think some of the way the scientific model, because it's incredibly reductive, we take things down to their lowest denominators. We don't, I can't remember whose book it was that I read it in, but they were talking about, we stopped thinking about food as food. We started to think about it as vitamins, minerals, and macronutrients. And then thinking about those things in isolation and going, well, you need so much of this and so much of this and so much of this and so much of this. Because it's reductive, food is a synergistic whole. It's that whole, it is greater than the sum of its parts thing. And the way we think about things in that reductive way, I don't think is serving us. Because we think about health in that same reductive way. We have nephrologists and cardiologists and bone doctors and brain doctors, and I can't remember all the other names for them. We don't look at us as a thing. We don't look at us as a gestalt system because it's too complicated. It's easier to reduce it to the parts. It's like Jason Fung. He's a nephrologist. He's a kidney doctor. But his speciality now is diabetes, effectively. So he's stepped out of his discipline and is now looking at a human being as a holistic whole and going, well, if this bit of the system is broken, it's because upstream, that bit's, this is what's happening, which modern medicine doesn't do. We isolate our things and we treat symptoms we don't prevent. We have a sickness management system, not a health system. And so that bringing it down, that scientific method of things, of breaking things down into calories, it's part of the reductive nature of the way we thought. We've broken it down to the simplest unit available, and that's what we now trade in. Whereas your idea of nutrient density, that's a really, really good, I'm spending £5 and I'm getting this much nutrition. It's, or I'm going to steal that and start talking about that in my group.
Yeah, I mean, you can attribute to me if you like, that's fine.
Oh, completely.
Yeah, but please share it. I think it's integral, you know. I think that when it's one of the main, last remaining, almost, you know, legitimate criticisms of suggesting people eat like this, it's a kind of accusation of first world problem snobbery, that you're really saying to people who have maybe socioeconomic issues and psychological issues or family issues or past trauma issues, that if they could just sort themselves out and buy steak every day, then they wouldn't have their issues. And that's not what I'm saying at all. It's that you can really solve a lot of problems by making positive steps in the right direction. Here's a framework to do it.
Well, there's a great amount of not epidemiological, but, you know, like population studies that prove that people that are the poorest are usually the people that have the most weight issues, because cheap food makes you fat, and it's simple as. And you are quite right in the fact that advising people, it is one of the things that comes up. And I, and at some point after the book I'm currently doing, I want to write a low carb on the budget book, because one of the main things is this is so expensive. But then you also look at it, well, you're not buying junk food, you're not buying like chocolate bars because you're hungry in passing,
a frappuccino.
Yeah, you're not buying them. You're probably not buying much paracetamol, ibuprofen, pain medication of choice for headaches, because they pretty much go away. You're not buying beverages that cost money, as I said, frappuccino or diet beverages of whatever, unless you choose to, and hopefully you are moderating those or cutting those out.
Deliveroo as well is so expensive.
Yeah, and all of that stuff that is basically like drinking your calories is not the way we evolved. And I personally think it's why I also don't really like bulletproof coffee as a concept. Detest coffee anyway. But in terms of the concept of you are drinking a bunch of calories in the morning, your body does different things to what you drink, to what you eat, because of the way you activate digestion with chewing. And your body seems to receive those in a different way. So drinking your energy is, I personally think, never a good idea. But even starting to drink diet drinks, again, they cost a lot of money. But then you come back to, with people that are on the lower rungs of society in terms of money, biscuits are cheap and they make me feel happy. And it's, again, that's all part of, well, yeah, they do, but you are then stacking up problems for the future. Yeah. You're not going to live as long. But sometimes it doesn't matter, because they are getting, and I speak from a complete area of privilege here. I am completely not on that realm of society. So my opinions are potentially not as valid as they could be. But they are living day to day. They're fantastic at managing money. They manage money far better than potentially someone like me could manage it, because they make every penny count. And what they can do is what they can do. And then something like doing low carb on a budget, it's then thinking about, but if I've got a family of four to feed and I've got £20 to do it for the week, that's pasta, that's rice, that's, and then how do we deal with that? And that's a problem that I potentially think would be a very much longer conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, you've got people like Jack Monroe, who does great stuff around,
he's awesome,
making food exciting and palatable if you've got a kettle to cook in, kind of thing. And you're using cans from a food bank, and that is, like you say, it's a separate issue, and it's hard to address that quickly, you know. It reminds me a little bit of the Labour MP when they were in power saying that they didn't really agree with certain restrictions on cigarette smoking, because it's one of the few pleasures that the working class has. I thought that was such an unhelpful statement.
Yeah.
he was the health secretary at the time. I can't remember his name, Scottish guy. But I've really enjoyed the chat today, and I really appreciate you coming on. Maybe you could tell everyone exactly how and where to find you online.
Okay, so I'm Nicola Howard. I am low carb in the UK, so everything is connected with that. So my website is lowcarbinthe.uk. Facebook group, Low Carb in the UK. There's also a specifically keto group as well, which is LCUK, All Things Keto, for where people who do want to do the measuring and the weighing and the whatever, they can do that over there. I also, what else have I got? Yes, and then of course my book's on Amazon, so you just search my name, Nicola Howard, N-I-K-O-L-A. And I've got the three books that I've written. The fourth one, Brain Willing, comes out at the end of the year. The best way, and of course on my website you've got buttons that you can reach out to me to have a chat with me, and then potentially either work with me in a group setting or a one-to-one setting. And I offer various offerings ranging from like 20 quid a pop up to £1,500 a month or even £9,000 a year, depending on what level of assistance you need to get your journey done on. So yeah, I think the easiest way of finding me is probably on Facebook. So again, in the Facebook page, Low Carb in the UK.
Okay, great. Once again, really appreciate it. Thanks again, Nicola.
You're more than welcome. Thank you.
Thanks for listening, everyone. Please don't forget to jump over to iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts and hit the subscribe button. And please don't forget to leave a 5-star rating and review to get the podcast in front of more eyes. This podcast is made possible thanks to paleocanteen.co.uk, which is my company. That's paleocanteen.co.uk. Thanks, and see you next time.